what you're thinking. You wonder why I chose her. Out of all the ladies in the world, it's just a first impression. What good's a first impression if you knew her like I do? It would change your point of view. If you could see her through my eyes, you wouldn't wonder at all. If you could see her through my eyes, I guarantee you would fall like I did when we're in public together. I hear society moan, but if they could see her through my eyes, maybe they'd leave us alone. How can I speak of her virtues? I don't know where to begin. She's clever, she's smart, she reads music. She doesn't smoke or drink gin like I do. Yet when we're walking together, they sneer if I'm holding her hand. But if they could see us through my eyes, maybe they'd all understand. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask you, is it a crime to fall in love? Can one ever choose where the heart leads us? All we ask is ein bisschen Verständnis, a little understanding. Why can't the world leben und leben lassen? Live und let live. Oh, I understand your objection. I grant you the problem's not small, but if you could see her through my eyes, she wouldn't look Jewish at all.
If you don't remember the scene for our opening song tonight, let me paint a verbal picture for you. Joel Grey is on stage at the eccentric little cabaret in Berlin, where he's master of ceremonies. With him for this song is a gorilla, or at least someone dressed in a gorilla suit. He dances with her, presents her a ring which he attaches to her nose. He shows the audience the big red heart on his chest. He sings of how love does not care about the artificial boundaries created by society. But of course, it's a satire, as we're reminded by the last line, just which race it is that's getting abused in a Germany where the power of the Nazis is on the rise. Cabaret, and especially the last line of that song, was quite controversial in 1972 when it was released. It stepped a bit farther into the darkness than had previous musicals. It was not the first time a Broadway or a Hollywood musical had included death or abuse. Oklahoma, Carousel, West Side Story, it all grappled with those issues, among others. Nor was it the first musical to take on the issue of race discrimination. South Pacific, for example, included the wonderful song, You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. But Cabaret showcased the darkness of a growing anti-Semitism and the spectacle of hatred being drummed into a willing populace. The violence was not limited to one or two scenes. It was woven into the film in a way that broke cinematic barriers. It said that theater must be realer than real, and well, Cabaret took that to a new level. She doesn't look Jewish at all. Well, here on the New American Dream radio show, we don't care if you look Jewish or black or Oriental. We don't even care if you look like a Nazi. We believe you should have a chance to be heard no matter who you are. We'd even welcome the CIA or George W. Bush or Barack Obama if they wanted to talk on our show. We don't always agree with our guests. In fact, sometimes either Mike or I will have major reservations about what a guest said. But we absolutely believe in their right to say it, your right to hear it. That's something we stand for, something that's a big part of our new American dream. If you, listening out there, if you have something to say, let us know. We're pretty flexible. We just might be able to put you on the air if you have something that needs to be heard. Don't be afraid to stand up and tell people what you think. They don't want you to tell us what you think. For that matter, they don't even want you to think. They'd much prefer that you keep your mouth shut, your ears and eyes full of their propaganda, your brain chugging along at idle. They want the whole country to be a no-think zone, but we won't do it. It's not like we're protecting manatees by keeping our thinking to a minimum level. We're not protecting anything or anyone that way, only the status quo, only the powerful. We must speak up, we must protest, we must be active in our fight against complacency if there is to be any hope of a new American dream. I'm Chuck Gregory, and I'd like to introduce you to another fighter, my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guest Jim Fetzer, who was supposed to be with us last week, but we have him on this week. Also, Philip Ferrugio and Anthony Rayson. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Madison, Wisconsin, somewhere else in Florida, Chicago, and wherever you are. It's the American dream, and you have to be asleep to believe it. If you read stuff like the articles from Information Clearinghouse, which we recommend, you get a dose of reality thrown right in your face. The depth and breadth of the American military empire with 1,000 bases overseas and 4,000 here at home, the cost to maintain those and how we don't even really care or know, the treatment of Bradley Manning, people still held at Guantanamo after all these years, and the lie about who did 9/11 that still drives our national zeitgeist and psyche, as well as national policy. Wow. Well, as they say, there is a place, like no place on earth, a land full of wonder, mystery, and danger. Some say to survive it, you need to be mad as a hatter. And if you come to understand this mad place, the others will tell you that you are entirely bonkers. And I'll tell you a secret, all the best people are. Remember, they want us to be afraid, as they told us in the anthrax letters. We are not afraid. It is they who are afraid of us. That is why they work so hard, have so many big, guarded, expensive buildings full of people working day and night to deceive us. We are that good. And eventually, after a long struggle, many nights that we want to quit, and many winter afternoons when we think it will never turn out well, and a heroic adventure that takes us many amazing places. And after many big famous battles against those who would kill laughter, over the misty mountains, into dungeons deep and caverns old, against mighty and dangerous dragons and demons and evil kings and queens, we will win. And that will be very, very cool. It will be awesome, dude. And we will be able to return to our cozy, pleasant home and press a cup of something warm to our breast, put our feet up, and enjoy the company of those we love. And then maybe a nice, long nap.
The Adventures of Barack Bin Laden, International Terrorist Leader. This week we find BOBL sending drones to murder wedding parties, sending troops to start a brand new war in Syria to Afghanistan, lording over a worldwide prison camp, over a slave labor force drilling for oil that will eventually bring about global climate catastrophe. And yet, you know what, guys? He's just a regular guy. Barack Bin Laden loves sports. He mows his lawn, changes his own oil. He loves football, basketball, baseball, and golf. His March Madness bracket clings to the refrigerator with NASCAR magnets. Drinks beer like a real guy. He rolls his shirts to his elbows because he's just a regular guy. Wife's name's June. His sons are Wally and the Beeve. He works at a regular real guy job in an office and comes home for dinner, reads the paper, and watches a little TV with the family. Well, how was your day, Beaver?
Oh, gee, Dad.
What'd you do today, Wally?
You know.
Well, June, the food is sure good and the house looks nice.
I was here all day alone. I had nothing better to do. After supper, Barack Bin Laden goes into his man cave, smiles wide to his family as he closes the big wooden double doors. He pulls out a fat, long cigar and a short glass of bourbon, sits behind the big oak desk. He puffs and sips and he thinks. When the cigar is finished and the drink is followed by a second, Barack Bin Laden pushes his chair back to be able to pull open the big middle drawer. He draws out the shiny silver revolver and the one silver bullet. He spins the chamber and kisses his temple with the barrel, and then points it at the forehead of Bo the dog, wagging his tail, gazing up at him from the shiny hardwood floor. He thumbs back the hammer and pulls the trigger. Click. He pats the dog's head and returns the weapon to the drawer. He opens the big wooden doors with a big smile, sends the kids off to bed, waits until June calls it a night, and then Barack Bin Laden climbs out the front window into the bushes and into the black helicopter on the front lawn. Join us next week for another episode of Barack Bin Laden, Worldwide Terrorist Leader, and we will join BOBL as he sneaks into a neighbor's window at midnight and kills everyone with a knife and leaves just in time to kiss his own wife and children goodnight and catch the last segment of SportsCenter before going off to bed himself.
Tonight, our first guest was actually supposed to be last week's second guest, but he didn't make it, and he was kind enough to agree to appear on the show tonight. A former Marine Corps officer, Jim Fetzer, has conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, events of 9/11, the plane crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone, and current events. He's always on top of things, and we're so proud to have him as a regular columnist. And without further ado, I'm going to play his column.
The recent filibuster by Rand Paul, which was, as I recall, the sixth longest in the history of the Senate at 13 hours, was intended to protest the failure of the candidate to become the head of the CIA to clarify whether or not drone strikes upon American citizens on U.S. soil were permissible under the law. It was eventually resolved when the Attorney General, Eric Holder, sent a letter to Rand Paul regarding the administration's policy, which stated what some may think was definitively that the U.S. would not use weaponized drones to target American citizens on domestic soil. But let me read this letter from the Attorney General, Washington, D.C., March 7, 2013. The Honorable Rand Paul, United States Senate, Washington, D.C., 20510. Dear Senator Paul, it has come to my attention that you have now asked an additional question. Does the President have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil? The answer to that question is no. Sincerely, Eric H. Holder, Jr. While to most Americans that may sound as though it settles the question, it raises the further invitation for clarification of what it means for an American to be engaged in combat on American soil. Indeed, there are some very expansive interpretations of the war on terror that characterize the entire continental, actually all of the United States, as a combat zone. Under that very broad and expansive definition, it might be supposed that individuals who may be construed as giving some form of support to terrorist entities, terrorist states, however those are conceived by the government, where the imagination runs wild, could nevertheless be targeted for what the rest of us might view as the exercise of our freedom of speech. It has long been my opinion that what it means to be an American is to have the right to criticize your government from A to Z. And if that's not what it means to be American, then it doesn't mean anything. So that I have, in fact, taken full advantage of those opportunities during my own radio broadcasts here on the New American Dream and elsewhere, to make multiple points about what's going on in this country and the way it appears to be dissolving, devolving into a military police state, including extensive discussion about Homeland Security, its acquisition of 1.5 billion rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition, which, as most of you know by now, is not even permissible for use in combat under the Geneva the Hague Treaty of 1899, 2,700 light tanks of a kind that have been used in Afghanistan and Iraq that are capable of withstanding improvised explosive devices, 7,000 automatic weapons of the kind that Congresswoman Senator Feinstein and others are seeking to ban here in the United States, but which Homeland Security describes as personal security weapons. What in the world is going on here? I have raised these questions. I have even written to Homeland Security to ask for the answers to a dozen questions, where you can find the letter I submitted along with substantiation of why these questions are important and how we know they make a difference. They matter, including, by the way, the observation that a subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Intelligence released a report on October 3rd of 2012 explaining that based upon a study of 680 fusion center reports, where fusion centers merge federal, state, and local anti-terrorist activity, they had found not one, zero, zilch, nada, none, indication of any terrorist activity or of any terrorist threat, which means, based upon that rather substantial sample, that there is no terrorist activity in the United States. Therefore, why in the world is Homeland Security acquiring this vast stockpile, stunning in its quantity, of ammunition that isn't even permissible for use in combat? 2,700 light tanks, 7,000 automatic weapons. We know about the 300-plus FEMA camps. We know about special arrangements they've made to use mortuaries and funeral homes should there be an excess casualty count that overwhelms hospitals and medical centers. What in God's name is going on? Something is wrong. This is right here in the United States. This is your America. This is today. Go to Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer, and check it out. Homeland Security, the Unanswered Questions. Just read them through and ask yourself what has happened here. So, we have this man, Rand Paul, addressing one of these crucial questions about the use of predator drones right here in the United States. It is a serious question, sad to say. Eric Holder may or may not have answered that question. Frankly, I believe that the use of language by politicians and lawyers is so elastic that being assured that weaponized drones cannot legally be used to kill Americans who are not engaged in combat on American soil does not actually answer the question, because as a critic of American foreign policy, as a critic of U.S. domestic policy, that may qualify me as providing support to terrorists in the eyes of men like Eric Holder and some of the senators who have opposed him. It's fairly stunning. But John Nichols, who's an associate editor for the Capital Times, which happens to be a wonderful newspaper. When I first moved to Wisconsin, I was so proud to have the Capital Times, a progressive newspaper, published here in Wisconsin. And not long thereafter, it folded and became a weekly insert in the Wisconsin State Journal. But he's raised the question why some of these senators, such as McCain and Graham, are afraid of Rand Paul. And I'd just like to share some of his thoughts and then comment on them. When Arizona Senator John McCain and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham attacked Kentucky Senator Rand Paul for conducting a 13-hour filibuster that challenged the national security consensus among the elites of both parties, they employed derisive terms usually reserved for Obama administration nominees and liberal Democrats. But Paul, who filibustered the nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA, is one of Obama's most ardent critics, and he will never be confused with a liberal Democrat. So why the fury? The junior senator from Kentucky, with his filibuster, with his griping about Pentagon bloat, with his distaste for the U.S. role as policeman in the world, offends the neocon sensibilities of McCain and Graham. The senior senators maintain the Dick Cheney agenda within the GOP. They want the party to be enthusiastic, not just about wars the United States is fighting, about wars it might fight. They don't like questions about the use of drones in the U.S. or abroad, and they don't care for the suggestion that Congress should check and balance military adventurism. McCain and Graham have succeeded in positioning congressional Republicans as advocates for the Cheney Doctrine, which defends targeting perceived or potential threats, no matter how constitutionally dubious those actions might be. Indeed, they are more than ready to discard the Constitution whenever it gets in the way of war making. I wish I could say what John Nichols writes is wrong. Alas, that is not the case. Dick Cheney, in my judgment, the most malevolent individual to ever occupy high office in the United States, was a key player and may even have been the executive director of the events of 9/11, which were orchestrated by the U.S. government in collusion with the Mossad to create a spectacular event that would instill fear into the American people in order to induce them to reverse U.S. foreign policy, which had always been in the past never to attack any nation that hadn't attacked us first, not to mention our long tradition of civil rights and civil liberties. By the passage of the Patriot Act, we had a single stroke, created the Homeland Security and gutted the Bill of Rights and made it possible for wars of aggression to be launched by the United States, which began, of course, with Afghanistan within 3 weeks of 9/11, continued into Iraq, has now extended to Libya, were now involved in Syria, if not overtly in training the opposition, which includes mercenaries who are being supplied and abetted by Israel with funding from Saudi Arabia in attempting to depose the leadership of another Arab state. Everything that's happened to American foreign policy since 9/11 has been beneficial to Israel, not to the United States. These same senators made an uproar when Chuck Hagel was nominated, even though he himself had served as a Republican senator, because he believed there was a difference between the interests of the United States and the interests of Israel, that they do not always converge, which was subjected to an obscene satire by Saturday Night Live. If you haven't seen it, you don't want to miss it. Because between the extreme efforts of Senator Dianne Feinstein and John McCain and Lindsey Graham to promote gun control and the interests of Israel, we have a recipe here for disaster awaiting the American people, because if we are disarmed, we lose our most important capacity to resist tyranny by our own government. I wish it weren't so, but that's how things stand today in the USA.
This message is from Harper, Random, Collins, Bantam, Simon, Penguin, and Schuster, America's book publisher. You've heard of the Harry Potter series. Well, that author has retired, and that's left a big gap on the Walmart bookshelf. So we are pleased to announce the Killing Ben series by the Navy SEALs who did or will do the killing. We think you'll love the tales of terror, adventure, and terror. We think you will eat up Killing Ben Cohen and Killing Ben Affleck. There will be low-light bar scenes, fast fingers finding passwords on really cool computers, Tom Cruise running fast, Killing Ben Roethlisberger, Killing Ben Franklin, Killing Ben Stiller. There will be car chases and people jumping out of fast pickups on county back roads with country music playing, animated jumping over mooses and squirrels. Killing Big Ben, Killing Ben Bernanke, Killing Ben Hogan. There will be books and movies and coffee mugs, T-shirts and tiny toys. Killing Ben Stein, Ben Kingsley, and Benjamin Netanyahu. Benjamin Harrison, Benny Goodman, Ben Gazzara, and Uncle Ben's Rice. Look for the Killing Ben series in your Walmart aisles soon. How it was done by the Navy SEALs who were there or will be there soon. In on the action, right up close. It's true. There will be T-shirts. Killing Bo Peep, Killing Quasimodo, Killing Cruella, and Captain Hook, too.
Our second guest tonight, Philip Ferrugio, should be calling in any moment now. He's the son and grandson of Brooklyn, New York City longshoreman, and he's a freelance columnist. He works as an environmental product sales rep and has been an activist leader since 2000. In 2010, he became a local spokesperson for the 25% solution movement to save our cities by cutting military spending 25%.
Chuck, where will Phil be calling from? Is it in Florida?
Yes, I believe it's just south of Daytona Beach. I don't remember the name of the town.
And where's that from you?
Oh, it's about 4.5 hours from me.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it on this or that side of the...
It's on the Atlantic coast, just as I am. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's just like you going down to the Twin Cities.
Oh, that's... Okay. Philip
has just called in, and Philip, we've already introduced you, and I hope you will go ahead and tell us about the anniversary of evil.
All right. Well, I think you've asked me to actually read this piece that I had. It's been posted on about three or four websites since Monday. So that's that's encouraging. You know, as a writer, I don't get paid for this, so it's good to see a lot of people, you know, put my work on. Okay, please forgive me for what I'm about to say, but each time I tune into a sports event lately and see the pomp and circumstance of our, quote, brave warriors, unquote, it angers me greatly. As with other nations' military personnel, I am sure that most of our young soldiers are brave. To carry a weapon and be put into harm's way is not an easy task. Sadly, to carry a weapon and cause the citizens of another country to be in harm's way is what our nation's leaders have ordered them to do for so long. Korea, Vietnam, Grenada, Panama, Afghanistan, and Iraq, about a few of the places that our military has been sent to occupy and engage other peoples. In each instance, there was absolutely no moral reason to do it. It has always been about natural resources and, quote, spheres of U.S. interest, unquote, that underwrote these actions. On the morning of March 19, 2003, this writer awoke and walked into the living room to watch the boob tube. I knew before going to bed the night before that my country was going to be attacking Iraq. On all the mainstream and cable news shows, we were fed the government's line exclusively. One needed to watch the Canadian news shows on C-SPAN to get actual fair and balanced reporting. That morning, as I tuned into CNN and watched the shock and awe bombs being dropped, I knew that evil had once again dissipated reason and moral thinking. Weeks earlier, one of the only cable talk news shows that presented viewers with both sides of this argument was canceled. Phil Donahue had made sure to give the hawks and doves on the Iraq situation a chance to debate each other. We found out later, after the show's cancellation, that Donahue's producer was ordered by MSNBC, owned at the time by defense contractor General Electric, to make sure that there would always be two hawks for each dove as guests on the show. Yet the gang that runs this nation made sure that even one anti-war voice was one too many, including Phil Donahue himself. So we invaded a nation that posed no threat to us. We destroyed the infrastructure, and we destroyed tens of thousands of its population. Now imagine, in the heat of summer here in America, with temperatures hovering around 90 degrees each day, if you had no drinking water and no electricity. Imagine having to stand in line in that sweltering heat for a chance to bring home a few buckets of water. Think about how unbearable 90 degrees would be without air conditioning, and then remember that Iraq's temperatures average well over 100 degrees in the spring. Food would be scarce, as well as gasoline. Soldiers patrol the streets and are ready to fire at any male who looks threatening. This is what shock and awe creates when a bully gets his way. Dan Rather told his viewers that he would follow his president into battle. Katie Couric pranced through the halls of her network shouting, "Marines rock!" We applauded our brave warriors, and flags were hanging from many homes in my neighborhood. Now, I need not repeat the stories of American Muslims being detained and not being charged with anything except being a Muslim. Scores of Muslim men were beaten up and their stores and homes violated by angry mobs. This level of animosity permeated throughout many neighborhoods in America where the Muslims lived or worked. One man, calling himself a local journalist, was echoed by his wife during an interview with me and said, quote, "Why even send in our soldiers? Just nuke the whole damn country and be done with it." Another woman, a young mother of a five-year-old, said to the clerk at a store I was shopping in, quote, "We had to go in. After all, Saddam had WMDs pointing at us here." I asked her to be quite honest with me, that if her son was 19 years old instead of 5, would she encourage him to sign up and go fight the good fight? She smirked and walked back to her monster SUV. 10 years and on, look at the state of our nation. We are not only close to financial failure, but moral failure as well. It doesn't matter if it is a Bush or an Obama, they all serve this evil military-industrial empire. It doesn't matter if they label themselves Republicans or Democrats, they ultimately serve the same masters, the masters of war. Mr. Obama is sitting on a presidency that broke even the Bush Jr. record for military spending. he won't ever even debate the need for 900 bases worldwide. Instead, he will nickel and dime to make cosmetic cuts in this war empire spending, while our cities and towns face bankruptcy, and most of our citizens have lost their moral compass. Wake up, America, and become real patriots by saying no to empire.
Philip, it is no wonder that this has been published on so many sites, because it's a very powerful statement, and we as a nation really need to remember what happened 10 years ago. I have a cousin whose birthday is on the 19th, and I used to kid him about what a terrible birthday present he got.
Yeah.
Back in 2003.
You know, it's really funny. It's not funny. It's ironic, because every Tuesday I stand on the street corner in my neighborhood, and I have a big sign. I think I mentioned last time I was on. I have a giant sign that I had printed at a print shop, so it can be read. It says, "Save our cities. Cut military spending 25%, close all, end all occupations, bring our troops home now." That's what the sign says, big sign.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, because on Tuesday, it happened to be the 19th, and I was out there on the corner standing with my sign to face the traffic that comes to the corner with the light. And I tell you this, Chuck, and it was very crowded. You know, I live in Port Orange, and this is the air, this type of year when a lot of people are down here, all the snowbirds. And all I can tell you was a lot of traffic. I can tell you this. I was out there for 45 minutes. It was pretty warm out that day in the sun. Only one person blew the horn and waved at me. And everyone else who looked at my sign or looked at me, there was nothing. It was just total apathy.
Hmm.
Absolute apathy. I didn't even get anybody yelling at me. I mean,
that's
you know,
what I was
going to
say. You didn't get anger reaction even.
No. I mean, you know, when we first started doing this in my town back in 2004, we started in September to protest the occupation and invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. So at that time, right before the election, there was a lot of anger towards us, you know, and there were also a lot of people blowing the horns, but a lot of anger. I mean, people were cursing us out and calling us commies, but now there's not even that. There's just complacency.
Yeah, complacency is even worse, really, than opposition.
I agree. You know, when I know why that is so. I'm going to tell you my opinion why that is so, because it's been I'm out there every week, so you know you get a kind of a pulse. Here's my opinion. And as a matter of fact, we even stopped going out there until after the election, because in October up to the election, it was a waste of time to be out there, because all the people cared about was Republican Democrat. Obama Romney. So, you know, having the issue that we had out there didn't faze a lot of people. But I think the complacency is because the same people that blew the horns and waved us in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, they then rallied behind the Democrats and Obama when he ran in 2008. And they really felt that Obama was going to bring change.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I think now what's happened is that some of them are embarrassed, the ones who voted for Obama and the Democrats, some of them are embarrassed, but the majority of them are apologists. They want to fit a square peg in a round hole, so they're in denial and they're apathetic. The other side, they have the feeling, well, you know, it's not our guy. These are not our guys that are in power, so we don't give a shit. that's the reason.
I think that's depressingly accurate. Really is.
I'll tell you something else. You know what? There's a library here. I'm a big library person,
mm-hmm.
and I think I mentioned on the last time I was on that I did some checking with the county budget office. The Volusia County Library System has been operating at 66% of the funds they had up to 2007. So from 2007 and now, they're operating at around 66%. They had maybe 70%. They had over 28 to 30% cut, almost a third actually cut in their funding over 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know when you go into any library, things are not the same. They don't have as many new books, blah blah blah. The staff is cut, and I'm friendly with a lot of the librarians, and some of them are very sympathetic to my columns, you know. But here's the sadness. When I talk to him and I say, you know, I'm out there. I used to stand in front of the library for about a year.
Yeah,
we used to stand right outside the entrance, you know. And I said, you know, we're out there every Tuesday. Why don't you know, if you're not working, come out and join us. They're like mice. They're like little mice. You know what I'm saying? They're like mouse. They're so mousy. The American public. I mean, the German lady came over to me a year ago in front of the library, and she says to me, you know, she said, if this was in Germany right now, there'd be 100 people out here with you. She said, there's only two guys out there, you and this old man. She said, there'd be 100 people out here if this was Germany in front of this library. She said, you Americans do not like to protest.
That's true. I mean, you know, it may be the way we started out in protest of Britain, but we've lost that. We've really lost something.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the Occupy movement, and I had joined in with them like about a year ago, December, I think it was. I started going to their meetings over here in our town, the Daytona area. They had a group.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of nice kids, really. I mean, they were nice kids, but they really, you know, when I mentioned about the empire at the meetings and I said, because they were talking about every single issue, Chuck, you could think of. You know, we got to occupy this. And one guy wanted, he wanted to do something on banning, you know, bottles, plastic bottles and things of that nature. And I said, listen, I said, these are all great issues. I said, but don't you guys understand? It's the empire. We have to protest, occupy the empire. That's what the military-industrial empire. And it's like they didn't want to be bothered with that. They wanted to talk about the homeless, you know, and about feeding the poor. And I said, well, don't you understand? If we cut back this empire, we'd have so much money to do all these other things. You know?
Yeah.
And it's like they didn't want to connect the dots. They just wanted to have their own little issue, you know, their own little issue that they wanted to, you know, marry.
Mm-hmm.
And it faded away. The Occupy movement here has been over for a long time, maybe, 9-10 months already.
Yeah.
You know, they don't even have meetings anymore, I don't think.
Oh, really?
And I used to beg them, seriously, I used to beg them. You know, we have a demonstration against the Iraq and Afghanistan occupations in Daytona on Thursday nights. I said in Port Orange on Tuesday afternoon. I said, go out and join these people. They wouldn't come. Not one kid came.
Well, it's a sad commentary. We're going to have to cut this short now, Philip. But
I'm glad that you had me on. I really am.
Thank you so much for being on the show. We'll look forward to hearing from you again next month. And can you tell the listeners where they might find you on the internet?
Yeah, they could. There's one site where the woman is really nice. You know, Wendy Banks. She puts all my work up. So I would say just go to that site for the time being. It's Sleuth Journal. Sleuth. Sleuth Journal is the site. You can Google. They can Google Sleuth Journal and they'll get her site. And she was nice enough, I think it's sleuthjournal.com. She was nice enough for the last 9 months now to put everything I send her on. So you can catch my work there.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and have a good night.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
For decades, centuries, America and the world has been protected by those strong enough, smart enough to hear the voice of honor calling to their hearts, those brave warriors to whom we owe our freedom. Who can forget Dorothy Day, Emma Goldman, Eugene Debs, George McGovern, Peter Morin, Amon Hennessy, Lucy Parsons, Big Bill Haywood? And today we salute those who continue to answer the call.
The few, the proud, the women from Code Pink. Food Not Bombs, a global force for good. Be all you can be. Join We Are Change or your local 9/11 truth group today. Aim high with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. An army of one or two or three at 4 a.m. underwater through the swamp with a hammer in their teeth, over the fence, through the fence, into the building to hammer on United States military killing machines and destroy them. The Plowshares Movement, defending freedom and humanity since September 9th, 1980. We're looking for a few good women in black. Be part of the action. The world can't wait. Veterans for Peace. It's not just a job, it's an adventure. Peace is our profession. Join the Occupy movement. There's strong, and there's Catholic workers strong. Semper Fi, Ruah.
Our third guest is Anthony Rayson. Anthony Rayson is a retired Chicago freeway toll booth operator, having spent 30-plus years in heavy traffic. Anthony Rayson is also a publisher, an activist, an anarchist. One of the things he does is stay in touch with writers who happen to be prisoners, and he publishes those writings and distributes those writings, and in doing so, he gets out the real heart and soul of America, which is the heart and soul of the American prisoner. The American worker is no more, but the American prisoner is more ubiquitous than ever. The American prisoner represents the real heart and soul of America. We are so glad to be able to say that Anthony Rayson will be joining us each month as a regular columnist and helping us to hear from the American prisoner. Welcome, Anthony, and please take it away.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, good.
I got a nice piece I'd like to read. It's the first chapter of a very popular zine. It's actually a three-zine set. It's a 100-page zine called The Last Act of the Circus Animals. It's by two anarchist prisoners, an African and African and Europe anarchist prisoners in Ohio, Travis Washington and Sean Swain. So I'm going to read the first chapter. It's kind of like an adaptation of Animal Farm as seen through modern day prisoners, as it affects circus animals. So here's how it starts with a couple of quotes. Book one, The Pacing Panther. Thinkers aren't limited by what they know. They can always increase what they know. They're limited by what puzzles them. Because there's no way to become curious about something that doesn't puzzle you. That's Daniel Quinn's My Ishmael. When you control a man's thinking, you do not have to worry about his actions. That's Carter G. Woodson. And man's true liberation, individual and collective, lies in his emancipation from authority and from the belief in it. That's Emma Goldman. Okay, the first chapter is called I Remember. There was once a young black panther who had been captured from the wild and brought to the circus where he was to be trained to perform stunts and tricks. Early on, the ringmaster noticed that this was a stubborn animal, for it was only under the most brutal conditions that he would obey the ringmaster's commands. But the ringmaster reasoned that eventually he would come around, just like the other animals. Now, over time, the panther had grown older and had indeed learned quite a few tricks of the trade, but he had also learned much about the ringmaster and the circus in general. Most of the other animals at the circus felt that the panther was odd because he was uncannily quiet and distant. Moreover, he constantly paced his cage. This confounded the other animals because whereas they would sometimes pace to stretch, this panther never stopped pacing. So one evening after the day's show was over and all the animals had been locked in their cages, curiosity got the best of a Siberian tiger that was caged across from the old panther. "Hey, panther," the tiger growled, his voice like a bag of gravel. The panther stopped in his tracks and looked through the rusty bars in front of the cage at the bulky cat across the aisle from him. He acknowledged the tiger. "What do you want, tiger?" he asked, his shadow falling across the clump of yellow straw in the corner of his cage. "I know you've been here for quite a while now, and it's really none of my business, but why do you constantly pace that damn cage?" the tiger asked. The panther hesitated, his dark figure illumined by the dim track lighting suspended from the ceiling. His piercing eyes glowed from the darkness as he answered, "Because I remember." "Well, what is it that you remember?" the tiger inquired further. "That I am panther." The tiger was puzzled by this response. "What does that have to do with you pacing all the time?" he asked. "I have not forgotten," the panther replied. "You have not forgotten what?" the tiger questioned impatiently. "That I am panther." "But, Mr. Panther, I still don't understand why you can't sit down and relax," the tiger said, taking his own advice and lowering itself down on his haunches. "Because I do not want to die, I will not let him kill me," the panther sternly replied and resumed his walk. "Who's trying to kill you, Mr. Panther?" asked the tiger. After a moment, the panther answered, "The same one who is killing you, the same one who has killed many of you already, the ringmaster." Now, all of the other animals who were normally whooping and hollering had fallen silent, for rarely did the old panther speak. The tiger had become frustrated with the panther because he seemed to be talking in circles and not making sense. He knew that the old black cat had been there for a long time and thought that perhaps he had gone mad. But the tiger was not sure, so he continued. "Mr. Panther, you say that you pace your cage because you have not forgotten that you are panther and because you don't want the ringmaster to kill you. But surely you will not be killed for relaxing. Look at me. I'm sitting and I'm quite alive. So what you have said doesn't make any sense." "Yes, Mr. Panther," a huge bull elephant interjected a couple cages down from the tiger. He stood at the front of the cage, his eyes fixed on the panther. "I, too, am puzzled by what you have said." At this point, many of the other animals joined in and voiced their desire for the panther to explain himself. So the panther slowly walked up to the front of his cage, thought for a moment, and said, "All right, I will tell you what I mean. Do you see that old heap of a beast lying in the corner of his cage over there?" he asked the panther, nodding in the direction of the cage between the tiger and the elephant where an old mangy lion slept. "Are you referring to the lion?" the tiger inquired. "Well, yes, at one time he was a lion," said the panther. "Yes. Years ago, when he first arrived here, he was a mighty lion. He roared, he clawed, and bit at his bars trying to get out. He gave all of his trainers hell every time he got the chance, resisted all their attempts to train him. He would not do anything the ringmaster told him to do. But after a while, the ringmaster's powers of persuasion started to wear on the lion, for he had learned that if he didn't obey the ringmaster, he would be beaten and thrown back in the cage. Moreover, he knew that if he did not obey, he would not eat. So slowly but surely, he began to give in to some of the ringmaster's demands. At first, he would sit when instructed to sit and reluctantly go where he was told to go. But at night, back in his cage, he would still claw and gnaw at the bars. And when he tired of that, he would pace back and forth for hours at a time. Occasionally, he would look over at me, our eyes would lock, and I would see that he was still lion. However, as time grew on, he started giving in to more of the master's demands until there came a time where he would even jump through hoops and rings of fire for the master. Eventually, he became the master's favorite and one of the main circus attractions. Now, all of the animals at the circus aspired to become one of the ringmaster's favorites, for obtaining this status meant more food, a roomier, more comfortable cage, and more out of cage time. Normally, these most prized possessions were held by the chimpanzees because they were considered the most intelligent of all the animals. But occasionally, a member of one of the lower species would be allowed to ascend to one of the top positions so as to inspire a sense of hope in other members of its species. The tiger was especially ambitious in this regard, so he interrupted the panther to pose a question. "Wait a minute, Mr. Panther. You're saying that old ball of fur over there was once the master's favorite?" "Yes," the panther said. "He had become a great performer, and it seemed like he had won the master's affection." "So, Mr. Panther," the tiger interjected, "are you saying that if I do everything master tells me to do, sit where he tells me to, and jump through rings of fire for him, he'll make me his favorite like the lion was?" Perhaps you would, growled the panther. Well, the tiger said excitedly, if that's all I have to do, then. I said, perhaps, tiger, the panther interrupted, depending on how well you behave. But even then, there's no guarantee, because you have a lot of competition. The ringmaster likes it like that. The more competition, the better. Besides, you don't want to know what happened to the lion, he asked. Don't you want to know? Yeah, tiger, be quiet and let the panther finish, one of the chimps shrieked from his expansive cage in the front of the range. Now you know you wouldn't say that to me in my face, the tiger growled back. You pull on back in that big-ass cage up there and shut the fuck up, punk bitch. Oh, you want to growl and be big bad tiger now? But you meow like a motherfucker when his master tells you to do something, the chimp retorted. The panther watched as the scene that had become oh so common back in the housing area began to unfold. Other animals joined in the fracas and began arguing amongst one another, their voices echoing off the aluminum windowless walls of the housing area. But before it got too out of hand, the elephant interceded. Hold up, he trumpeted, drawing the attention of the animals. Are you all going to let the panther finish speaking or what? The bickering amongst the animals trickled down to a few grumbles. Yeah, one of the monkeys shrieked from the back of the range. What happened to the lion, Mr. Panther? After a moment, the steady hum of the huge industrial fan high up on the wall at the back of the range ruled the night. The panther continued. Well, he died, the panther said, pausing for a moment to let the gravity of what he had said sink in. Yes, the ringmaster killed him. For a while, he was the star attraction. And during that time, he enjoyed the relative benefits that come with that status. More food, the big cage, all that. But as you can see, he paid a steep price. For I noticed that over time, his roar became less thunderous. And when he would return to his cage at night, he no longer paced it. He had stopped gnawing at the bars that confined him, and the lion in his eyes grew dimmer and dimmer until there was no lion left in them. Yet he jumped at every opportunity to please the master, till one day he had grown too old to learn new tricks or perform the old ones. And so the ringmaster withdrew his favor. He threw him back in that small cage and never let him perform again. Yes, he locked him in that cage over there and left him to die again. And what you see curled up over there is what's left of him. But what do you mean, Mr. Panther? The elephant asked, watching the rise and fall of the rib cage of the emaciated lion. The lion is alive. He just sleeps all the time. Mr. Elephant, I will answer your question, the panther said, turning his head toward the elephant. But first, allow me to ask you a few questions. Who are you? Where did you come from? And how long have you been here? That's easy, the elephant replied. I'm Circus Elephant. I've spent my whole life here. This is my home. Well, Mr. Elephant, what if I told you that that is not true? What if I told you that you have not always been Circus Elephant and that this is not your home? The panther asked, staring into the elephant's eyes. Perceiving an attack on his memory, the elephant reared up on his hind legs and trumpeted. I would say that you are a liar. From as far back as I can remember, I have been Circus Elephant. So are you questioning my memory, Panther? The elephant asked angrily. Oh, no, Mr. Elephant, the panther said calmly, shaking his head. I am simply saying that over the years, the ringmaster has managed to persuade you to forget. Now listen to me, and please don't take offense to what I'm about to say, because it is the truth. I remember when they brought you here years ago. You woke me up at night on several occasions, banging against that cage, trying to get out. The panther turned his gaze toward the tiger. And you, Mr. Tiger, you came shortly after Mr. Elephant there. You used to pace that cage incessantly, wanting to be free. You, like me, the lion over there, and many of the rest of you have not always been here. You have not always been circus animals, forced to do silly little stunts in order to eat. You have not always lived in cages, no. The ringmaster brought you here from the free world. You were once free, he exclaimed. Just then, the voice of a young orangutan that had been born in the circus rang out from down the row of cages at the rear of the housing area across from the monkeys. For years, he'd occupied the smallest of all the cages. Free? What does free mean, Mr. Panther? He asked. The panther pressed the right side of his head against the bar, straining to see the orangutan as he spoke. Mr. Orangutan, has there ever been a time when the master tried to make you behave a certain way and you refused to? Yes, the orangutan replied. That used to happen a lot when I was younger. Do you remember how you felt at that time? Yes, he answered. Well, that's what free feels like, the Panther said, turning back toward the Tiger. And Mr. Tiger, has there ever been a time when the ringmaster cracked you with that whip and you felt like mauling him every time, the Tiger growled? Well, that feeling is your desire to be free. And that's just a glimpse of what freedom really means, the Panther exclaimed, considering each animal he could see from the cage. There is a world where we are all free, a world where Tiger is free to hunt, where Monkey is free to swing from tree to tree and eat as many bananas as he wants, a world where Lion is royalty, where Elephant does not have to stand on his hind legs and wait for a master to give him peanuts. There is a world where Orangutan knows what it means to be Orangutan, where there is nothing trying to stop him from being Orangutan. Yes, there is a world where no species of animal is considered better or more important than any other species, where Tiger and his way of life is just as important as Chimp and his way of life. And I lived in that world. And like most of you, I was taken out of that world and brought to this world of cages, to a world where the mighty Lion, King of the Jungle, is forced to relinquish his crown and reduced to a heap of meat. A world where not only is Elephant prohibited from being Elephant, but where he's made to forget that he is Elephant and told that he never was. So you all ask me why I pace. It is because I do not like this world. It is because this is not where I'm supposed to be. It is because I remember where I came from, because I remember that I am Panther, and Panther does not belong here. It is because I remember the Lion, and I remember that as long as he was pacing, he too remembered that he was Lion. He remembered the world of the free, and that memory kept him alive. You ask why I do not sit down and relax? It is because I do not want to forget that I am Panther. It is because I do not want to die like the Lion did years ago. For the moment he stopped clawing at the bars that held him captive, the moment he stopped pacing, was the moment that he forgot that he was Lion. And in that instant, when he forgot that he was Lion, he died. With that, the Panther began pacing again. So that's just the first little chapter.
Anthony?
Yeah.
We're about out of time, but could you tell us who wrote that?
Well, this is written by Travis Washington and Sean Swain, two anarchist prisoners in Ohio.
Excuse me, I interrupted you. Where are they at now?
Well, Sean is going to be moved to a supermax prison shortly. Right now he's in Mansfield, Mansi Prison in Mansfield, Ohio. And they're moving him to Lucasville.
Okay.
Because of his outspokenness. And Travis, I don't know which gulag he's in right now.
I'm sorry, I kept interrupting you, but could you tell us the names once more?
Travis Washington, an African anarchist, and Sean Swain, a brilliant Euro anarchist. He's written a lot of stuff that I carry.
Is that a longer book?
Yeah, that's just the first chapter. That was just the first seven pages of a 100-page three-book set.
So well, it sounds great.
Yeah, prisoners and high school kids love it.
Well, I'm going to have to say goodnight, but maybe I'm looking forward to the next installment of that one or whatever else you have for us next month.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony.
I got so many things I don't know what to choose from, really. But I'll have something for you for sure.
It's awesome. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And now we bring you the Charles Bukowski Target and Walmart Easter Day Card Special American Collection. Tell those Americans around you what you really think of them. A card designed with you in mind. Some sample selections from the Bukowski Target Walmart Easter Special American Collection. I don't hate people, I just feel better when they're not around.
The best often die by their own hand just to get away, and those left behind can never quite understand why anybody would ever want to get away from them.
Sometimes you climb out of bed in the morning and you think, I'm not going to make it, but you laugh inside, remembering all the times you felt that way. We're all going to die, all of us. What a circus. That alone should make us love each other, but it doesn't. We are terrorized and flattened by trivialities. We are eaten up by nothing. There is a loneliness in this world so great that you can see it in the slow movement of the hands of a clock. People so tired, mutilated, either by love or no love. People just are not good to each other, one-on-one. The rich are not good to the rich. The poor are not good to the poor. We are afraid. Our educational system tells us that we can all be big-ass winners. It hasn't told us about the gutters or the suicides or the terror of one person aching in one place alone, untouched, unspoken to, watering a plant.
Sometimes you just have to pee in the sink. Death at last is a bore, no more than pulling a shade. We do not die all at once, generally, but piece by piece, little by little. The young die hardest and live hardest and understand nothing. But they're the most generous and the truest and better fit to lead than the cautious wise.
I couldn't get myself to read the want ads. The thought of sitting in front of a man behind a desk and telling him that I wanted a job, that I was qualified for a job, was too much for me. Frankly, I was horrified by life, at what a man had to do simply in order to eat, sleep, and keep himself clothed. So I stayed in bed and drank. When you drank, the world was still out there, but for the moment, it didn't have you by the throat. The fuckers, there I feel better. Goddamn human race, there I feel better. The problem was you had to keep choosing between one evil or another, and no matter what you chose, they slice a little bit more off you until there was nothing left. At the age of 25, most people were finished. A whole goddamn nation of assholes driving automobiles, eating, having babies, doing everything in the worst way possible, like voting for the presidential candidate who reminded them most of themselves. The Charles Bukowski Target and Walmart Easter Day Card Special American Collection. A card designed with you in mind. And now a message from the United Tribes, from the Algonquin to the Seminole to the Cherokee to the Lakota to the Apache. Americans, air quotes, your time is up. Look what you have done. You are a disaster. The biggest there has ever been. Climate change, massacres, fascism, poverty, the whole manifest destiny, westward expansion, you're always getting better, load of crap.
Just keep it on moving, right down the Golden Gate Bridge into the Pacific Ocean, and just go away. You're the last American idiot to leave. Please turn out the lights. Please exit through the gift shop.
The Revenge of the Bedbugs, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, it means that anyone interfering with factory farms where pigs and other animals are crowded together in pens and pretty much driven crazy because pigs are not stupid, anyone interfering with that is a terrorist. And then after we bloat the animals with toxins and drive these intelligent creatures crazy, we drive them into a big building and slice their throats, hang them from chains by their legs, cut them up, and then eat them. Recently, a truck driver for an Ohio packing plant found a document apparently written by pigs whom he had just taken in for slaughter.
It was written on nice animal stationery, and it said on top, four legs good, two legs bad. The truck driver scanned down the paper, saw some big words, thought he'd better turn it in, so he gave it to the slaughterhouse manager, gave it to the manager of the cut floor, passed it to the manager of the kill floor, who gave it right on back to the truck driver, who was out hosing the blood from his truck in the parking lot. But he sent it to his congressman, who made a law that anyone this smart, who cared about every living creature this much, was nuts. Should be charged with terrorism. And so they did that. They made law to keep everyone safe from the smart ones who cared about every living creature. But by then, they were already dead. Now, have a good night. Don't let the angry bedbugs bite.
Well, it has been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. You might have seen that George H.W. Bush still lives. That old snake that we see sneering in the back room on the night his son was dishonestly named President of the United States. The one who lied that he was out of the loop. The one who ordered the killing of thousands of people in Panama. The one who ordered the building of many new prisons to get tough on drugs and criminals in America. It was all a scam. All to get elected, gain power. George H.W. Bush, the one who sneered at the funeral of Gerald Ford when he mentioned from the podium the killing of John Kennedy. The one who claimed he was not in Dallas that day, but there is a photo showing he was. The one who sits in the front row at the ball games on national TV and is applauded, not hit with tomatoes and fists and handcuffs, because he has been so successful in concealing the truth from the American people all these years. The one who has said that if the American people knew what he has done, they would string him up by a light pole. Well, actually, there were some guys right here in Mount Liberty, some guys who suspected the truth about George H.W. Bush, who cared enough to find out the goddamn truth about our 41st president. They were not the leading citizens. They did not write the editorials or sign the loans or even cut the hair of those who did. They inhabited the underground, the earth, the destitute, the hated, the laughed at, the so-called criminals themselves, and they understood. They knew where the power resided, where the truth could be found, what the reasons were, where the bodies were buried. They could not understand, and they wanted to find someone to ask why there may be such a stink about even talking about the killing of a rich so-called leader, and yet the real-life slaughter of thousands, millions of poor people goes by without a whisper, a passing breeze in the trees that is gone and forgotten by the time the hail fellow well met in the cook's hat in the backyard shouts out that the hot dogs are ready. So with nothing better to do, they decided to fight. AGB, they said, killed George Bush. Here's some apparently recent graffiti found in D Block. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you, bad boys? The men of D-Block are Mark Pontiac, Bobby Ford, Stephen Baltimore, Martin Mumford, Billy Morning Dove, Miguel Mendez, and Alfred Arthur. The new guy is Michael Zags, who is on his way to the jail, snatched from a downtown construction site for threatening the life of former President George H.W. Bush. The jailer is Don Burton. Well, there is the jail and there is the outside. Some on the outside are headed to the jail. Some few realize that and some have no idea. Unknown to the men in D Block, an underground pirate radio station had begun operating in downtown Mount Liberty. One woman's plan to get around the arteriosclerosis blockage of non-information provided by the regular radio stations. Paul Novotny sat in traffic counting the steps on the water tower. The noonday glare in his eyes pissed him off. He clenched his teeth and slammed down the visor. It's the sensitive types who climb the water tower with high-powered rifles, Paul resumed his reverie. They drive us to it, the bastards. Hiking his sweatpants into the fold between his ribs and chest, Paul raised his chin to view himself in the rear view to see if he was gay. Paul strained to tune the radio. In his peripheral vision, he saw the light switching to yellow. He sensed the cars around him sliding away, leaving him. The white Camry with gold piping behind him shouted its horn. Paul held up a finger to the rear window and continued to search the dial with his left hand. Paul Harvey, good day. You look wonderful tonight. Sirhan, with atrazine. Google, I'm Bob Edwards. You're not, whispered Paul. The Camry edged up, nudging Paul's tan escort. Paul decided to diss the out-of-state plates. He leaned into the brake pedal, motioned the Camry around, and walked the radio arrow right. The right lane cleared, but the Camry driver beeped his horn, rolled down his window, and shouted at Paul to get the heck out of the way. She had to be there. The light clicked to red. The lanes filled in around Paul. The Camry inched back, a black and white police cruiser slid up next to Paul. Paul dragged the shifter into first and stared straight. He turned his head right. Officer glared until Paul looked away. He watched the light while moving the knob with his right hand. The light clicked to green. Paul moved away within the flow. He spread his thighs and picked his balls free. He signaled and moved to the right lane, put his left hand to the window, and gave the Camry a no-look finger as it moved past.
Paul turned right down Nebraska Street. Looking up the hill, he saw the walkway between Norwest and Penny's, the sidewalks littered with walkers, lingering fog, orange and yellow blinkers. Paul steered with his knees while he lit an old gold. He rolled down his window. The KZOO morning show, Mike and Ike, went to commercial. Paul eased in behind a purple minivan and tried again. He heard crackling. His arms ached. He noticed a familiar tone. He backtracked and fine-tuned. "Good day, my friend," the deep female voice brought the day's first smile. Paul cranked the wheel and on the green cut off a yellow cab to park on the curb. Put the car in gear, stopped the engine, turned the key, sighed in relief at the return of the voice. This is Radio Free Liberty, broadcasting the underground seeds of the revolution with legs astride the weather ball in downtown America. Paul pulled the lever to recline in his seat. You can get no further into the heart of America, the beast. This is it. The stomach, the belly, the soul, the lungs, the gut. Paul tugged the emergency brake, pushed the button locking all doors. He pried each heel from his tennis shoes and watched the road and foot traffic from below the low bill of his cap with steely, narrowed eyes. He strained to see the weather ball on top of that one building next to the cop shop. When the weather ball be red, we all be dead. The weather ball be green, Wall Street obscene. Weather ball is blue, they come looking for you. Weather ball be white, no brothers in sight. Yes, the weather ball is black, bad times ahead. But you know that rain's good for the crops, don't they say? But today we play. We're going to send out some Jackson Brown, Lou Reed, and Mr. John Prine for you this morning. This is Atlanta at KFU.
Pretending to sleep, Paul watched a mail carrier in shorts and knee socks coming down the sidewalk with an antenna sticking out of his bag. Remember, all next week I'll be on a live clandestine remote from the Southern Hills Mall. Bring your Walkman and we be jamming. The mailman passed without incident. Paul swiveled his head slowly and saw two brown men on the corner, a line of sweat down both of their white T-shirts. Aha, thought Paul, wetbacks. He turned up his radio as the sheriff's car sped by. Paul scrunched farther down. You know, as I sit in my window and watch all you hurrying to work, I wonder if we've used up all of our tokens, you know, if we're coming to the end of the line, she said. I've been hearing about the Truth Commission in South Africa. Why don't we have a Truth Commission in the United States? Who killed Bobby Kennedy? Paul shot up and worked the knob as she drowned in static. You killed Martin King? Why? Excuse me, Mr. Haig, Miss Kirkpatrick, Mr. Abrams. Just how many people did we kill in El Salvador, and did we care if they had their heads cut off, their organs stuffed into their mouths as they died? Not a problem? Paul stuck his right hand into his front pocket. He dug way down, fishing for a cigarette. He pulled up what looked like a watermelon lifesaver. He picked off what lint he could and stuck the candy into his mouth. Yes, Mr. Clinton, how you doing? Why can't Leonard Peltier get a fair trial? Paul curled his toes as his lady at the radio went on and on. What is the FBI really up to around here? Let's organize a Cub Scouts tour of the Hoover Building and that CIA compound and that National Security Agency thing. What's this all about? May we help you, citizen? Well, yes, I'd like to read that file that I paid for and that one over there, too. I'll take two of those chartreuse folders with the burgundy clips. Yes, honey, Mr. Director, come sit on my lap and you tell me what you've been up to today now, child. Such a big boy.
Paul felt motion. He felt as if he were slipping off the planet, like Apollo in free fall. Boom! His rear bumper hit the front bumper of the yellow taxi behind him. Paul jerked around and saw the car was empty. He started his car and pulled up a few feet. "You know what I'm saying," she said. "Poverty is not the problem. It's the solution. We need to look for the lie, friends. Look for the lie in the eyes, on the tongue. Listen, y'all, I got to be gone. I hear the pitter-patter of little jackboots. Lou and John will have to stay the night with me. Seems that we're out of time. No more tokens to play today. Here's that Jack Brown I've been promising. Lives in the balance. I've been waiting for something to happen. Y'all be good. Till tomorrow, stop obeying."
As the music played, Elena Usak swiveled the chair to look out her window. She tried to guess the vehicles that had her show tuned in. Maybe that pickup, that garbage truck, the Eldorado in front of the bakery with its motor revving. The station went to static before the song finished. Paul opened his eyes and moved his seat up. He flipped the visors and turned off the radio. He released the park brake and started the car. He looked in the mirror and turned into traffic, causing a Budweiser truck to slam on his brakes. Paul checked his side mirror and drifted to the middle lane. He moved up the hill in jerks, stopping at each light, keeping his right foot on the brake and half on the gas. When he reached the top, the sun chimed 9 o'clock. The sidewalk people sat down at computer terminals and the beer truck lurched into a grocery parking lot. Paul chugged over the crest, past the Catholic high school, and disappeared down into a maw of white houses.
Alana saw Paul Novotny pull in front of the beer truck. She saw the county sheriff, Jeremiah Williger, driving slowly past. From her second floor perch, Alana noticed the navy blue Ford and the two insurance men who could have been Federal Communications Commission agents in another life. Springtime morning air chilled the sweat on her forehead. She closed her eyes, sucked down the pancake aroma from the Nebraska Cafe below her, and considered her good fortune. The wind today floated past from the north, keeping the hog slaughtering smell of the south end over across the river. She twirled back, shut down her equipment, and walked into the kitchen for more coffee. Her living room was full of plants and radio machinery, secondhand stuff, microphone, mixing board, transmitter, cart machine, CD player she picked up at a ham operator swap meet during the Sturgis rally summers ago. All on a bare, shining hardwood floor. The antenna ran up the inside wall to the roof and connected to the line, running up the side of the first security tower, giving her use the largest building in the city.
They were getting close. She felt it. She thought about staying off the air for a while. Returning to the office living room, Elena shook her head to get the sticky hair out of her eyes. Holding her cup with both hands in front of her face, she stepped close to the poster of a bridge in Prague, hoping to see her father. The laminated newspaper columns and her diploma from the U attempted to fill the south wall and cover the pockmarks in the legal pad yellow texture. She moved in swaying elephant steps to the bookshelf. Uneven strips of boards from the alley dumpster, supported by chipped bricks and concrete blocks. She had lifted them from the First Star bank site on Western Avenue and hauled them up the two flights in her backpack on successive August solo Ham's Light party nights. She scanned the titles for something new, journalism text, Radio for Dummies, the complete manual of pirate radio, Radio Free Berkeley yearbook, basic electronics, FCC rulebook, the checkbook of verbs. Elena returned to the window of the sidewalks and streets now empty. She shook her head and snorted softly. She was probably the only person ever to move to Mount Liberty to get away from the Twin Cities. She put the cup under her nose and breathed deep, expanding her economical chest. She squatted and set the smoking cup on the window ledge and, resting her chin on her arms, welcomed the chill of the spring morning.
Why did that angry little man park at the curb each morning? Was the beer man single, or did he have three kids in a house with no trees up on a hill east of the mall? What would it be like to be the older man there in the suit, walking with a briefcase from the 50s, from his brick home and grandkids in Morningside? Maybe she could become a teaching Franciscan at Briarcliff, eat with a group, play cards, or walk giggling to a movie in the evening, riding a station wagon to the dog races in Omaha on the 4th of July. Drink keg beer from flowered cups on a fairy tale June evening, sitting on donated lawn chairs in one humongous wooded backyard.
Elena sipped her coffee and spilled on her top. She patted her breast and saw that the square forge sat empty. She leaned her forehead into the screen and saw the heel of a black shoe going into the building. She sprinted into the dining room, flopped onto her stomach, and pressed her ear to the floor. She heard a flurry of scuffled and thuds coming up the stairs. Shh, boom, 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 boom. Elena sprang. She grabbed her jacket from the wall, scooped tapes into her backpack, unhooked the screen, lifted it, and brought it inside, setting it against the wall. Two alternating hammers beat the door. FCC, open the door. A plastic photo ID slid under the door along the wood floor. She got on all fours to read it. Damn, why were good-looking guys always mad at her? Elena stepped through the open window, grabbed the ledge, and eased herself down to hang.
A retired farm couple from east of Sergeant Bluff, seated in one of the front booths, were startled when the toes of Elena's white Reeboks popped down to slam the middle of the front cafe window. Elena heard her door crash down and she let go. She hit the sidewalk, flexed her knees. She hurried into the cafe, stumbling, catching herself on the building. She sat down at the counter and ordered coffee with pancakes. She reached into her jacket pocket for paper and pen. In a right-hand scrawl, she began to take down the details of the scene around her. The diners heard above them the banging and slamming of furniture. A flurry of squad cars skidded to the curb. Officers rushed in, pounding up the stairs opposite the south wall of the cafe. Puffs of plaster poofed down from the textured ceiling like fairy dust. Alana continued to jot notes in her white rectangular pad tucked under her saucer. Alana's transmitter exploded on the sidewalk. The cafe owner wiped red hands down the back of her pants and stood by her front window talking to the couple in the booth. Alana slurped her coffee, watched her pancakes steam in the serving kitchen window. The remainder of the dozen customers stood by the front and south windows, kibitzing the law. Channel 4 television van jumped the curb to park on the sidewalk. The Channel 9 crew squealed and stopped crossways in the street. Boom! Boom! Alana's CD players landed in the street. Shrapnel tinked the cafe window. Down came her speakers and microphone. Out flew her books and shelves, diplomas, family photos. The old couple jumped and raised their hands to their heads. The crowd at the windows ducked as if a plane were buzzing them. Yellow plastic ribbons connected the cafe to the parking meters and the rose bush and the Egyptian pot outside Bobby's barber shop. The cafe owner herded her customers back to their food. She found Alana's pancakes and set them down. Alana asked for more coffee. The owner met a line of customers at the cash register. The old couple looked through the C and A at the pile of life on the sidewalk. There was a stack of pink and blue underwear carried out by a female U.S. Marshal and dropped on the stack. A Hispanic FBI agent from South Omaha had two halves of Alana's Prague poster in her in his hands as he came down the enclosed steps, turning sideways to allow a TV cameraman past. A circle of uniformed officers kept news crews away from an interior strategy huddle by the men in the suits.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up our triple play night on the New American Dream radio show. We thank all three of our guest columnists who participated tonight. We especially thank those of you who are listening to the show. We hope you'll be back again next week, same time, same place. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Hung it up three times. Now I'm going to call him back. Ah!
Yeah, whoever you are, don't ever call us tonight.
The microphone was great.
Thank you.